Take your Bibles this morning as we resume, after nearly a two-year break, our series entitled Christian or Church History, Christian History. And I would like to read Psalms 31, verses 13 to 19. Psalms 31, verses 13 to 19. Each one of our lessons, my desire is to at least begin each lesson with a verse that I feel is appropriate to the setting of each lesson. Psalms 31, may I invite your attention to verses 13 to 19. For I have heard the slander of many. Fair was on every side. While they took counsel together against me, they devised to take away my life. But I trusted in thee, O Lord. I said, thou art my God. My times are in thy hand. Deliver me from the hands of my enemies and from them that persecute me. Make thy face to shine upon thy servant. Save me for thy mercy's sake. Let me not be ashamed, O Lord, for I have called upon thee. Let the wicked be ashamed, and let them be silent in the grave. Let the lying lips be put to silence, which speak grievous things proudly and contemptuously against the righteous. Oh, how great is thy goodness, which thou hast laid up for them that fear thee, which thou hast wrought for them that trust in thee before the sons of men. I have chosen to borrow these words that came from the hand of David as he describes his own life experience as one who was vilified, as one who was defamed, one who knows how it is to be hunted. He knows how it is to be on the run from his enemies, and yet this same verse can be applied to the greater David, the Lord Jesus Christ. But the gist of these words can also be applied to the next 200 years of church history that we will be examining. We are going to come across, during the next 200 years, some very grievous accusations that were given by the heretics and by the skeptics and by the Greeks and the Romans as they levied these accusations, these titles, these nicknames, these slurs and these slams upon the early church of centuries 2 and 3. And beloved, believe it or not, the church was able to prosper. The church was able to grow, even though she had pressure from within her, as well as pressures on the outside. Well, before we get started on our first lesson, if you noticed this morning when you came in, there was a red folder on your seat. That folder is simply given to you as your own information package. You may want to pick it up. And the quicker I can get this done, the faster we can get into the lesson. This information package was put together with a little bit of time, a little bit of effort, and a little bit of shekel, meaning money, which means I would like you to do something with it other than laying it down somewhere for the dust or for the cat to lay on. Inside, you're going to find some maps. As we go through this lesson, I will be referring to certain locations within the Roman world during the next 200 years of church history. So I would like you to be somewhat familiar of where we're going. There's also a list of the 12 apostles, and according to church history / tradition, whatever term you want to use, it kind of gives you a gist of From all the writings of the church fathers, it kind of gives you an idea of what they did, where they evangelized, and where some of them probably ended their lives as a martyr for Christ. Then there are two outlines on history that are given there for you. And beloved, you can feel free to write in those, mark it, make all the notes that you want. There's also a list of the Roman Caesars, starting from Julius Caesar all the way up to the end with Constantine. That is there for you to get some type of an appreciation of the historical background that we will be journeying in. And then for every family here, there are two additional pamphlets that were purchased for you by the church. One of them is a church outline on a Reformation timeline, as well as something I believe to do with the apostles as well. So, beloved, that is given to you as nothing more but a tool, a handy-dandy thing that you can use to expand your horizons. The second thing I want to mention before we plow into our lesson is the word caution. The first three lessons, this Sunday school lesson and the next two, are going to contain a lot of historical data. And some of you, and maybe in school, had a hard time dealing with history. Well, that is a problem that you need to crucify and you need to deal with. You need to get over any hang-ups you have about history, names, dates, places, and times. It is my responsibility to dig out all the information I can, put it in some type of a logical order, and then to teach it in such a way that it will be enjoyable and at least whet your appetite and at least to cause you to appreciate what the church has gone through in 21 centuries of her existence. Okay? Something else by way of introduction. We're going to consider some people. We're going to consider some locations. We're going to consider some historical events. We're going to study some of the heretics. We're even going to look at, and even I will quote, some of the church fathers. I will give some attention to some of these people in a very cursory manner, kind of fast in general. Other individuals, we may stop and just look at some of their writings, look at some of their thoughts. Because, beloved, what they wrote and what they thought, unfortunately, still carries itself to the very day here in the 21st century. So there'll be some people that we'll look at in passing, other events, other places, other people we'll look with a little bit more detail. Okay? And then I would encourage you, if you can, either you can go online or go to the library or go to a Bible bookstore, try to get one or two copies of Church History Reference. And here's one of them. This is not even $10. It's called The Harpeth Concise Book of Christian Faith. In this book is simply nothing but the different people who made Christian history, and it has a lot of their quotes, what they believed, and some of the historical background. Even something as small and inexpensive as this can be a real blessing for you. And so, beloved, as I was taught in school, and even as I was taught in the Air Force, and I was taught by other pastors, you're only going to walk away from this lesson. You're only going to walk away with as much as you put into it, and as much as I put into it. So with that in mind, let's take our journey. We're going to study 200 years of church history. We're going to come across some characters. We're going to read some quotations that's going to make your toes curl. And hopefully there'll be some quotations that might either make you cry and get angry. Because some of the same issues that we are now dealing with in the time frame in which we live, those who lived in the second and third century were forced to walk through the same mud, the same mire, and the same valley. They grew and they prospered. When you read some of church history, there are people who will tell you who have made the conclusion or they've drawn the conclusion that it was the Christian church that brought the Roman Empire on her knees. The very influence of the cross of Christ conquered an entire empire. And then eventually would go to Europe and then eventually come to this nation and be planted here by our Puritan forefathers. Well, the first thing we're going to do is a little bit of geography. If you look up here, there's a big map of the Roman Empire. Okay? I'm just going to point out some very key spots that you need to kind of be familiar with because we're going to name them during the course of the next 200 years of history. This chart shows the full expansion of the Roman Empire at the height of her dominance. She ruled as far west as Spain and as far east as modern-day Iran, Iraq. As far north as Britain, and as far south as all of North Africa, to include Egypt and portions of the Nile River. That's quite a chunk of real estate to own and to rule. Do you see this line that's basically going from north to south? In the course of Roman history, the Roman Empire was initially divided in the minds of the emperors, but were eventually divided by way of jurisdiction. This line separates what is called the Eastern Roman Empire from the Western Roman Empire. And beloved, guess what? That division is still affecting us today. You have the Roman Catholic Church, and what do you hear quite often in the news? The Greek Orthodox Church, or the Eastern Church. So this division of the Roman Empire that begins to develop in the 2nd and 3rd century still lives on in the 21st century. It hasn't gone away. Well, the Western branch, or the Western section of the Roman Empire, the predominant language was Latin. And that gets translated into the Roman Catholic Church, whereby when I was growing up, when I went to Mass and Sunday school, everybody spoke Latin. That's still going on today, 20 centuries later. The Eastern Roman Empire, the predominant language is Greek. And if you go to Moscow today and you go attend a Eastern Orthodox version of a Catholic Mass, the priest does the liturgy in Greek. So 20 years later, we're still dealing with something that happened centuries ago. So you have the Roman Empire, and it was broken into Eastern and Western. Well, what are some of the key cities? Key cities you have to know. Well, of course, quite obviously, is the city of Rome located right here. Rome. Just think, when the prophet Isaiah was prophesying that Christ would be born of a virgin, and when the prophet Isaiah wrote that the Messiah would come in the 53rd chapter of his book and die a brutal death on the behalf of his people, the Roman Empire, or the city of Rome, was nothing more but a collection of huts. A collection of huts. It wasn't even a city nor a capital at that time, believe it or not. So the city of Rome. Okay? The next city I want you to be aware of is not a city, but the province of Gaul. When I use the word Gaul, or when I refer to a church father who comes from the province of Gaul, I want you to think of France. This is the region here, all of this region here that is now France, portions of portions of Western Germany, Holland, Netherlands, the city of Amsterdam, all the way down to the Pyrenees Mountains, which separate Spain from France. This entire region was conquered by Julius Caesar some four decades before the birth of Christ. He conquers this and brings it into the Roman Empire. But guess what? This becomes, in time, the beginnings of the Holy Roman Empire by the 9th century. And then this gets translated into Europe. Eventually, the very seeds of modern-day Europe are actually being planted in the 2nd and 3rd centuries of church history. The very seeds of modern-day European history. Britain, or its Roman name, Britannia. This was considered as the Wild West of the Roman Empire. We think of the Wild West with the cowboys and the Indians and the gunslingers. Well, Britain would be the equivalent of the Roman Empire's Wild West. You had some of the cantankerous, some of the nastiest, some of the woolly, wildest tribes roaming through Britannia. And they drove the Romans bananas. It took several Roman empires to cross the English Channel. Almost think of D-Day, only in the reverse. The Romans coming against these wild people. And they finally subjugate these people and they incorporate them into the Roman Empire. Well, during the next 200 years of church history that we'll study, there was a Roman emperor called Hadrian. And his Roman soldiers were getting fat, dumb, and happy while assigned there. So you know what he did? I can't afford to have my soldiers fat, dumb, and happy. And since there's no one else to fight, he put them to work. And you know what they built? If you look on the map, you see that black line? They built Hadrian's Wall. And guess what? You can get on an airplane today go to Scotland, and you can walk that wall today. It's still standing, 20 centuries later. He built the wall to keep the Scots and the Picts up here, and to keep the Romans safe to the south. This wall is over 160 miles from east to west. It was high enough, and every so often the Romans built towers, and there were cities along this wall. It became nothing more but a place of buying and selling, prostitution, temples to all the gods of Rome. People were making money, and you were even able, and when they built the wall, on both sides of the wall was a huge trench, whereby if the enemy tried to storm the wall, you have to go down into a trench, and the Romans can just ping you away, and if you made that, you have to climb back up out of the pit before you face this wall. Hadrian's Wall, it still stands today. Italy, one of you folks earlier mentioned, well, I want to know where Italy's at. Well, just find the boot. There's old Italy. There's Italy. There's Sicily. North Africa. All the way from the Nile, all the way across to the modern-day country of Morocco, to include the Pillars of Hercules. Anybody know what the Pillars of Hercules is? That's the Strait of Gibraltar. Beloved, you know that this entire region was basically Christian all the way up until the 8th century. Until who came? Muhammad. These people were solid Christians, and some of the greatest church fathers came from North Africa. Believe it or not, solid Orthodox church fathers came from North Africa. Well, when Islam came into play around 600, 700 AD, the Muslims, whatever term you want to give them, began to expand to the west until eventually all of North Africa was conquered at the edge of a sword, and then the Muslims crossed over into Spain. The Muslims also crossed over all the way to the gates of Vienna. Now, you listen to this about a sovereign God. You have the Muslims in Spain going into Gaul and France, and you had the Muslims coming into Vienna. If Western Europe lost both of those battles, you would be a Muslim today. You would have been a Muslim by faith. Because then Islam would have crossed over into Europe, eventually into England, and then to the shores of America. We would not have had Puritan forefathers. We would have had Muslim forefathers, and you would be living under Sharia law. Two battles. You had one Roman emperor here, and the Christian forces here, and for whatever reason, in the providence of God, he spared Europe from two major conflicts. Just two conflicts. And you'd be wearing different clothes, and you'd be praying to Allah versus Jehovah. Now, look at Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey. Now, you may want to refer to your map because maybe you can't see it because of the distance, but open up one of your maps. And as you do, let me kind of mention some of the sections of Asia Minor. Find in your map either one of your maps. I think the one that's white with kind of the tannish color shows it a bit more accurate. But as I read off these different provinces, I would like you to drop your eyes down on that map and see if you can find them. You see the province of Asia? Asia would be more to the west, right around in here. That's where you find the seven churches of Asia Minor in the book of Revelation. You see the province of Bithynia, and then there's Pontus. You see Cappadocia? The province of Cappadocia would produce three church fathers who stood strong on the doctrine of the Trinity, when many in the professing church were beginning to waver on that position. You see Sicilia in the southeast region there, that's where Saul of Tarsus comes from. And do you see Galatia, more like central in the northern part of Asia Minor? Well, beloved, that part of the Roman world, this section right here, this was heavily evangelized by the Apostle Paul. And when we study the next 200 years of church history, you will find out that not only North Africa, but this region of the Roman Empire did produce some very strong, very solid Orthodox apologists who were defending the faith. While the Caesars in Rome were looking upon Christianity as an illegal religion, these apologists were writing a defense of the faith to the emperor, outlining how logical and how reasonable the Christian faith is, and that we are not your evil subjects, we are law-abiding subjects. Please don't kill us. Well, some of these apologists came out of the fertile ground of Asia, in Asia Minor, that the Apostle Paul basically cultivated and nurtured during his travels. Okay? So Asia Minor was a strong region of Christianity. Look up here at the map. You have Greece. This was heavily evangelized by the Apostle Paul as well. So you have Italy, okay, Spain, France, Italy, Greece, Asia Minor, are the modern-day region, or the modern-day country of Turkey. Cyprus, you have two islands. Here's the island of Cyprus, and here's the island of Crete. Cyprus and Crete. Why is Cyprus so important? Well, beloved, we're told that Acts 11:19, you don't need to turn there, but when the Apostle Paul was Saul of Tarsus, and when he was unleashing persecution, and when he sanctioned the death of Stephen in Acts chapter 7, the Bible says in Acts 11:19 that the Christians who were living here in Palestine or in Judea fled, some of them fled to Cyprus, and brought the good news of Jesus Christ to that island. So the island of Cyprus was evangelized in part due to Saul of Tarsus killing Christians. What about Crete? Right here, the island of Crete. Well, beloved, we're told in Titus 1, verses 4 to 5, that Paul left his son in the faith, Titus, there to do what? To establish churches and to ordain elders. So are you getting a picture? The Apostle Paul, by the grace of God, was used to evangelize Asia Minor. He was used by the grace of God to evangelize the area called Greece. He would eventually go to Rome and give his defense before Nero. Indirectly, he causes the gospel to go to Cyprus. And now, here in the island of Crete, he has one of his preacher boys establishing churches, ordaining elders, and Paul is telling Titus what to do and how to expand the faith. You see how much influence one man, the Apostle Paul, had. One man. I want you to know not only the city of Rome, but there's another key city right here. Constantinople. When it was run during the Ottoman Empire, when it was in charge of the Ottoman Empire that fell, actually, after World War I, when the British came in, it was called Istanbul. Well, today it's known as Constantinople once again. When Constantine comes to the throne in the early 300s, he don't like Rome. He views the city of Rome as a cesspool. And so he builds Constantinople on the Bosphorus Straits. Guess what he calls it? New Rome. And Constantinople is very close to what name? Constantine. He named it after himself. So here's Old Rome, and here's New Rome. And beloved, guess what happens? You see this division between East and West slowly in the 2nd and 3rd century? And when you move into the 4th century, guess what happens? You have one bishop ruling in Rome who thinks he's top dog. Because he thinks he has a succession that goes all the way back to Brother Peter. The bishop in Constantinople, he says, hey, we got our keys to our city by Constantine. And he saw that sign in the sky that said conquer in this symbol. He was the first Christian emperor. Lo and behold, Old Rome and New Rome begin to take this division between the two empires, and they begin to build a religious wall between East and West. And then eventually, this bishop excommunicates this bishop, this bishop excommunicates this bishop, and the entire Christian world is going, who do we follow? Do you find stuff going on like that in the 21st century in churches? Huh? Party bickering, knocking heads, knocking shoulders, power play, people on a power trip. Is that still going on today in the 21st century in the Church of God? Well, guess what? Some of that shenanigans was going on even back then. Two more cities I want you to bear in mind. Nicomedia and the town of Nicaea. These two towns would come into play. Nicaea will be the center of the first ecumenical council, where Constantine, listen to this, Constantine's now on the throne. He calls 318 bishops at that time throughout the entire empire. And there was a heresy floating, and Constantine says, I want that heresy to be stopped, and I want you bishops to fix it. What do you got going here? You got the state dictating to the church what to do. Does that sound like 21st century America? State dictating to the church? But it gets even better. You know what Constantine does? To really kind of put his thumbscrew, he subsidizes the entire council. He puts them up in the best hotels. He takes these 318 bishops and he wines and dines them the entire time. And he told them, gentlemen, I want peace and security across my empire. And you Christians right now are causing all this ruckus over this teaching about Christ. I want you guys to settle it, and I want it settled now. That's the state telling the church what to do, how to do it, and when to do it. Nothing different 20 centuries later. Here we are today. Well, all that occurs here between the cities of Nicomedia and Nicaea. Okay, some other regions I want you to know. Syria. Here is Syria, right up in here. You hear Syria mentioned in the news, right? The Lebanese, the fighting the Syrians, so-called Christians blowing up Muslims, Muslims blowing up Christians. Nothing different. Nothing's changed. Here's the country of Syria. This was also heavily evangelized by the early church. And there's one key city I want you to bear in mind. Here's Rome, here's Constantinople, Nicomedia, Nicaea. Here in Syria, I want you to remember the city of Antioch. Antioch. That's the city that sends out the first missionaries, Paul and Barnabas, to the Roman world back there in Acts chapters 13 and 14. Well, this particular city becomes kind of like a real strong center of Christian teaching and Christian thought. And this is the school of the literal interpretation. This idea that the Bible is to be interpreted literally. And it was through this region, my dear friends, that we end up getting the received Greek text that underlines the King James Version of the Scriptures. It comes from here. Okay? Then we have the city of Jerusalem, which was destroyed in 70 AD. Now get this, most Christians do not realize this. 70 AD, the city is destroyed. Do you know what happens around the year 130 and 135 AD, the time period that we're going to study? You have another Jewish man comes on the scene, and he claims to be the Messiah. Now stop and think. The temple's been destroyed. The city's been destroyed. The city walls have been destroyed from 70 AD, and they were not rebuilt. The city had been left in shambles, and Jerusalem was basically a garrison for Roman soldiers. 130, 135 AD, another gentleman comes on the scene. He claims to be the Messiah, and he ticks off the Roman Caesar. The Roman Caesar says, that's enough. He sends an army, and he pulverizes what's left. And guess what he does? Guess what he does? He looks to his Roman map, and he says, I don't like that name, Judea. He erases the word Judea, and guess what name he puts on the map in that part of the region that we're still stuck with today?
Palestine.
Palestine has a reference to the Philistines. My dear friends, the Philistines no longer exist. So the Arabs and the Muslims who finally move into this region, when this Roman Caesar just pulverizes what's left, they assume the name Palestinians. And they're not even Palestinians. They're not even Philistines. They're Arabs. And all the commotion going on today in the Middle East is because a Roman Caesar said, let's change the name to Palestine. And that name still survives today, and it's making history every day that you and I are alive. Isn't that amazing? Okay, bodies of water, quickly, before we have some terms. Bodies of water. This is the Mediterranean Sea. Does anybody else know what the Romans used to call that? And most appropriately, anyone want to take an idea? This is the Mediterranean. They called it the Roman Ocean. Well, they owned it. Look at it. The entire Roman Empire circled the Mediterranean Sea. They called it the Roman Ocean. Two other bodies of water, at least three. Here's the Black Sea. Here is the Adriatic. And here's the Aegean. Adriatic and then the Aegean. So, beloved, I think that's the extent. Oh, just a few, okay, a few more. A few rivers. The Nile. Okay? The Nile River. And look up here where I have the black mark. You have two important rivers. The Rhine and the Danube. The Rhine and the Danube form basically the farthest extent into northern Europe that the Roman Empire was ever able to expand. The Germans, the Sarmatians, the Scythians, and the Armenians, and the Parthians. These people who bordered along the frontier of Rome in the second and third centuries, these people are going to begin to put pressure on this boundary. They want to come in and they want to enjoy the good life. They want to be Roman citizens. They want a piece of the Roman pie. And what happens is they begin to cross over into the borders, which causes other people to migrate a little further to the west. And so Roman Caesars would come back and push these people back across their land. Well, then eventually in the second and third and fourth centuries, who do you have coming in out here in the steppes of Asia? The Vandals, the Visigoths, Goths, Visigoths, Vandals, the Huns, they will come in and take all these poor souls, force them into the Roman Empire, and then these barbarians will come in and come hoarding right down for the prize, the city of Rome. And by the 5th century, the eternal city that had lasted about 1,000 years is put to the sword. History tells us that when Attila the Hun was coming down, the only stable force left in the city was the church. The Pope at that time, according to history, went out, walked into Attila's tent, and was able to buy off, or threaten, maybe with the wrath of God, and he held Attila at bay from invading the city and sacking it another time. That's what history tells us. Okay, now with the time left, we have to do a little bit of word definition. Very, very quickly. You may want to jot these down, or you can always come back and get my notes. But these are some terms, beloved, that you have to be aware of, because I'm going to be using these terms, and you have to be somewhat familiar with what the terms are. We've already seen the Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome, The Pax Romana will end in the year 180 AD, during this time in church history. Before 180 AD, you're going to have five Caesars called the five good Caesars. Many of these Caesars were actually philosophers. They did some of the greatest expansions to the city of Rome with magnificent building projects which still stands today. One of them was Hadrian with his wall there in northern England. When the last of the five good emperors dies, then the Pax Romana also begins to crumble. And what was this Pax Romana? Because this is going to cause conflict with the early church. The Pax Romana was this concept in the Roman mind: we want peace and security and tranquility at any cost. It even affected Constantine when I told you at that council, I want peace and I want it now, church. You solve this doctrinal issue now. And so he subsidizes it for them to reach peace and concord amongst each other. When I say the term Orthodox, what am I referring to? When I use the word Orthodox, what does that mean? Well, listen to these word definitions or this meaning. Orthodox means pertaining or conforming to an approved form of any doctrine or philosophy. It is that which is generally accepted by the whole. So, beloved, we can call ourselves Orthodox as well. Orthodox means that you believe the major tenets of the Christian faith: the deity of Christ, the blood redemption, the verbal inspiration of the Bible sufficiency. You believe that man fell into sin and that this sin has grievously affected him to the point that he needs a Savior outside of himself. That would be considered holding the Orthodox faith. When I use the term apostolic, what does apostolic mean? Well, apostolic means that which comes from the apostles, primarily their teaching. You got churches today who use the word, we are an apostolic church. Well, many churches who use that term apostolic is that they're so sick and tired of all the lackluster and the lukewarmness, they want to return to the early church's way of doing things back in that first century. We're going to do it the apostles' way. And so they'll use the word apostolic to kind of give that flavor or that flair. But when I use apostolic, I'm referring to the fact that we are an apostolic church because this church is based and grounded upon the writings and the foundation of what they taught and preached. What about schism? What is a schism? Listen to this. The word schism comes from the Greek word schisma, and it means to tear or to split. A schism means a division or a split, usually within an organization or a movement. A schismatic is a person who creates or incites the schism in an organization, or who is a member of a splinter group. The word is most frequently and usefully used about a religious division that occurs within a religious body with a defined organization and hierarchy. That's what you're going to hear the term schism. And remember the map that shows you east and west, the Western Roman Empire? And I told you how the Pope in Rome and in Constantinople, he wasn't called the Pope, he was called the Patriarch. And how these two begin to kind of like bang heads and one excommunicates the other and vice versa. Well, this excommunication leads to the Great Schism of the 11th century. And beloved, from the 11th century until now, there has been no official reconciliation between the Western Church and the Eastern Church to this day. Now, the previous Pope who died, Pope John Paul II, he did go so far as to say that Rome is wrong, please forgive us, and he held out that hand of fellowship and friendship. But the official schism that can be traced back to the year 1050-something A.D. is still on the books and is still being enforced today. That's a schism. What about a heretic? We've heard the word heretic, haven't we? What does that mean? The word heresy or heretic comes from the Greek word heresis, and it means a choosing or a faction. So the word heresy carries with the idea that it is a teaching that you willfully choose to hold and then to propagate. At first, the term heresy did not carry the negative meaning it does today. But as the early church grew in its scope and its influence throughout the Mediterranean area, various teachers proposed controversial ideas about Christ, God, and salvation, and other biblical themes. It became necessary then for the church to determine what was and what was not in accordance with the Bible. So in these next 200 years, picture in your mind, you got the massive Roman Empire squeezing on the church, because now that Jerusalem has been destroyed in the previous century, the Christian church stands out like what? A sore thumb. And now the Roman Empire begins to take her eyes and it shifts it on these churches and begins to bear pressure. And pressure led to persecution. And persecution led to martyrdom. And martyrdom led to some Christians denying the faith during this time. And while that's going on, my friends, you had people within the church saying, Jesus is not God. Then you had this little group over here saying, matter of fact, Jesus never had a body. He just appeared to have a body. You ever stop and think how that Roman soldier was nailing a ghost? And then there was people on that side of the world saying, man isn't really that bad off. He's just sick. He's not dead in sin. All he needs is a little oomph. Then there was another group over here saying, we just received the baptism of the Holy Ghost, and I am the Holy Ghost and my two female prophetesses. And by the way, we think that Jesus is going to come within our lifetime. That was going on in the second and third century. So picture their world. Beloved, step out of your shoes and put their shoes. You had the government bearing down. You had certain bishops and popes going around saying, I'm number one. You're number two, and you're number three. And then you had people sitting in the pews saying, I don't think that Jesus is God. What do you think, pal? Question, anything different 20 centuries later? Still going on today. When I use the term Catholic Church during these 200 years, it has nothing to do with Rome. The word Catholic means what? Universal. During these next 200 years of church history, the churches were known as the Universal Church or the Catholic Church in the sense that they were all Orthodox. By and large, they were on the same sheet of music. Now, they may have had certain differences on when they did this and when they did that or how they did that, but the core of their belief was Orthodox. And so this is called the age of Catholic Christianity, when everybody was on basically the same sheet of music. Church Father, and notice in quotes, Church Father, these were people who came to the surface with the Roman pressure and with the schisms and the heretics inside, and they simply were a voice saying, Jesus was God, and here's the reasons why. Jesus is not returning tomorrow, and here's the reasons why. Jesus did have a body, and it was imperative that he did have a body, and here's the reasons why. These were called the Church Fathers. Men like Justin Martyr, Ignatius, Irenaeus, Tertullian, Papias. These are men we're going to be introduced to. Men, were they perfect? No. Did they have some off-the-wall interpretations? Yes. But they were at least orthodox enough to defend the faith. Apologist. Who is an apologist? It is somebody who makes a defense of the Christian faith to either an emperor or to a cynic during this time.
Ecumenical Council, what does that mean? Well, the first true ecumenical council was in Nicaea in the year 325 AD at the instigation, not of the church, but of the emperor. Monarchal bishop. What is a monarchal bishop? I'm going to show you from history how in the New Testament each church was independent from the other, and each church had numerous elders. Guess what develops in the 200 years of this time period? This concept begins to develop that the bishop is different from the elders. And the elders and the bishop are very different from the laity. And in these churches, one of the elders rose to supremacy and he was called the bishop, while the elders were called presbyters. And during this period, guess what happens? The elders were now called priests. And during this period, the division between the clergy and the laity begins to expand. From what I read, some of the first signs to make a distinction, the priest and the elders began to wear colored robes. Distinction. And here's one for you. In my research, up until this period, pastors were not even paid. Giving a pastor or a bishop a salary set him distinct from the sheep that he shepherded versus himself. And then the ordination service became very elaborate, and get this, lifetime appointments. Well, beloved, when you sit in a position for a lifetime appointment, and you're the top dog, and you're answerable to no one, what happens to your power? It gets a little bit corrupt. All this goes on in these 200 years. So, beloved, put it all together. Come on now. You got the Roman Empire bearing like a bear upon the church. And during these 200 years across the Roman Empire, you're going to have little sporadic persecutions. And beloved, they were brutal. Brutal enough to cause some Christians to say, I'm not a Christian. They got so brutal, Christians turned over their copies of the Bible to the Roman officials and threw them in the fire. It got brutal. And then you had people inside the church saying, Jesus is not God. Jesus didn't have a body. My two prophetesses, you want your fortune told? Come in the tent and we'll take care of you, pal. You want us to lay on hands? You want the gift of speaking in tongues? Oh, Christ is coming tomorrow. You had all that going on. And then while all that's going on, how is the church going to react to the Roman pressure and from the heretics? We need leadership. And out from the elders came a superior head bishop. I'll solve the day. You just follow my lead. And I'll vanquish those heretics. And I'll protect my flock from Rome. Someone steps into the gap. Desperate times demands desperate measures. And this idea of a one ruling bishop begins to take on a new dress. And the concept of that one ruling bishop by the 5th and 6th century becomes what? The Pope in Rome. And then finally, dioceses. When the Roman Empire was going through these next 200 years, the other emperors who came along the scene just could not take care of all of that real estate. So guess what they did? They took the Roman Empire and they chopped it up into little sections called dioceses. When the empire fell and the only thing that was stable was the church, guess what happens? The senior bishop ruling in those dioceses was made the archbishop of diocese A, B, C, D, and E. And all the little churches in that diocese was under his scepter. And the elders, he picked the elders for all those churches. And those elders were down to one. Not plurality, but down to one elder. And he called them priests. And you couldn't make a move in that diocese without getting the attention and the permission of whom? The bishop. Does that go on today? This abuse of ecclesiastical power? Well, beloved, that's your introduction. So by the grace of God, use your pamphlet, use your information, and enjoy this portion of church history. To me, out of all of church history, I find these next 2 years, the next 200 years, the most fascinating portion to read and to study. Well, may God bless you, and may He give us grace to serve Him in our times. Amen.